From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, plastic, which these days seems like it's been dumped everywhere. The floating islands in the ocean are depressing and seriously dangerous, and they reveal where we are in the plastic story. From transforming our lives in the best possible ways to 6 billion tons of trash. We're talking about the problems of plastic and what you can do about it in just a moment.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's this photo in the June edition of National Geographic magazine, and when you first see it, it seems delicate and beautiful. It's a seahorse in the waters off an Indonesian island, and it's suspended there in the water, and that tiny, graceful tail has hold of something. And then you realize it's grasping a pink plastic Q-tip. There are a few powerful photos like that in the magazine. There's a stork shrouded in a plastic bag and a loggerhead turtle caught up in a plastic fishing net. There are also a lot of powerful numbers in the article that come with the pictures. 9.2 billion tons of plastic, 6.9 billion tons of plastic waste. To give you some perspective, the journalist Laura Parker says, imagine 5 plastic grocery bags stuffed with plastic trash sitting on every single foot of coastline around the world. And that would get you to the nearly 9 million tons of plastic trash that ends up in the ocean every year. Today in the program, we're talking about that National Geographic article. Later, we'll also offer some practical guidance for kicking your plastic habit. But first, Laura Parker is a senior reporter for National Geographic. She specializes in covering climate change and marine environments. Her work is part of the magazine's Planet or Plastic campaign. This is an initiative aimed at raising awareness of the global plastic crisis and reducing the amount of single-use plastic in the oceans. We have links to her reporting on plastics on our website, radiowest.org. Parker joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., and she told us that her interest in plastics began back in 2014. It was when Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 went missing, and searchers were examining satellite images in the ocean for signs of wreckage. And they kept getting these false alarms. Time after time, they would discover that this stuff they saw in the ocean, it wasn't a debris path. It was plastic.
And I, at that moment, said to myself, this is a story here. I'm shifting away from the search, and I'm going to write about garbage in the ocean, which I did. The first piece I did, I think, got 400,000 viewers looking at it, confirming that we were onto an interesting story. This has been going on for a really long time. Yeah. And, I mean, birds have been eating plastic since the 1950s. It's been, scientists have tracked that. What really came to light here is, and one of the scientists that I interviewed about this said, during the search for the plane, this was the first time, really, that she thought that the world's eyeballs were watching this. Yeah. And as we have seen in the 3 years, 4 years since then, the issue of plastic in the ocean has become a very big topic.
One of the things you point out in the piece, and it's important for us to say, because you give us a little bit of history about plastic, and it's important to say, as you do, that plastic itself is not the problem. In fact, you say plastics have transformed all of our lives, and mostly for the better.
That's right. I think somebody asked me, I'm asked this all the time, we should get rid of plastic. No, the world would, we wouldn't really be functioning. I mean, people need to stop and think about how much a part of their life plastic is, from our toothbrush to the car we drive, to the aircraft that we ride in. What the issue is plastic trash. 40% of plastic that is manufactured today is known as single-use plastic. It's usually used to wrap things in or package products. That's the stuff that has gotten out of control.
Yeah. It's interesting. You write about this 1955 Life magazine article, which celebrated, as you put it, the liberation of the American housewife from drudgery. And it raises this question of how plastics, as you write about it, first start to show their dark side, again, in this single, they become part of the culture, I guess, this single use, the idea of throwing them away eventually.
Well, that was a really original concept in 1955. We think that this stuff has been around with forever, and you've always been able to have a disposable plate when you go to a picnic. Well, it wasn't that way. Mm-hmm. So when this, advancements in the kind of plastic products that were being made really happened as a result after World War II.
Right.
Plastics were really used in World War II to create all kinds of things, from parachutes to helmets. So in the 1950s, it turned to the sort of a consumer market, and these things were considered these marvelous inventions. This was the Life magazine zeroed in on how they were going to make life so much easier for everyone, because you could just eat your dinner and then throw the plate away afterwards.
Yeah.
And so this was looked at as how wonderful these things were.
Give us a sense of the longevity of plastics. I mean, you point out right up front in the article that, for example, if the Pilgrims had packed their provisions in plastic on the Mayflower, that stuff would still be around in some form. What do scientists tell us about the durability of plastics? How long does this stuff stick around?
Well, that was originally one of the great properties of plastic, which was that it was, you know, lightweight and virtually indestructible.
Yeah.
Now they're trying to figure out what to do with it all. I put the Mayflower analysis in there because I was on my way to see a very prominent scientist in Great Britain who's been covering this for a long time, and he works in Plymouth, which is where the Mayflower embarked from. And I just started thinking about that. Some plastic sticks around for hundreds of years, some forever.
Yeah. It's interesting you write about how much plastic there is right now. And in the article you mentioned it's somewhere like 9.2 billion tons. And here's the salient point that you make in the article. Okay, we've got, you know, 9 billion tons, but you also say that almost 7 billion of that is waste. It's an amazing figure. And even more amazing, in fact, you use the word staggering in the article, is that 6.3 billion tons has never made it even close to a recycling bin. That's the amount of waste in all of that.
Yeah, that takes us back to we have disposable plastics, and they don't get properly collected or put back into the circular economy. That's just a way of sort of not only paying attention to the birth of a product and its life cycle, but also figuring out what is the proper way to deal with it at the end of its life. That happens in other materials and other industries, but it is not one of the strong points in the plastics industry. And so that's why we end up with these really, really large numbers associated with plastic and plastic waste and the amount that's not recycled.
Tell us a little bit about the work of Jenna Jambeck. She's an engineer and a professor at the University of Georgia. Because you talked to her to get a sense of just how much of this plastic basically ends up in the ocean.
Yeah, Jenna is she's an engineer, and so she has a different take on this and brings different academic skills to the issue. A lot of the people working on it are marine scientists, and she looked at it from an engineering perspective. And one of the key things I think that's important to remember about the plastics issue and where this is going today is they need to have really precise information, as precise as they can get, about what is the problem, how is the problem defined, where is the plastic, how much is there. They're still figuring those things out. Jenna's groundbreaking study that was published in 2015, which was only 3 years ago, and she's the one who sort of put together all of the analysis that came up with, I think it was 192 coastal countries contribute plastic into the ocean, and came up with the numbers of the rough guess, sort of the middle number being 8.8 million tons, I think it is going in every year, or the equivalent of 5 garbage bags for every foot of coastline. Mm. And that really, for the first time, put some numbers on what the scope of the problem is.
Because if there's some impression that this plastic is coming from ships, that's wrong, according to Jambeck. Most of this is coming from these coastal regions, and it's just making its way, being blown in and drifting into oceans. It's people just ditching stuff, throwing stuff out, I guess.
Yes, and a lot of, I mean, remember, most of this is coming from Asia, where there are, in the developing world, there are not landfills or metropolitan garbage collection systems that operate as efficiently as the first world. And a lot of it, there'll be a landfill, but it'll be next to a river, and stuff will slough off. Mm-hmm. So it's not as much as it's not the individual guy who drops his cup on the street and it ends up down the drain and washes out. A lot of it is they'll stuff in larger collection points, kind of just ends up going into the ocean. Rivers carry a lot of it into the ocean.
Do we have any sense, Laura Parker, and I want to be sensitive here, but that Asian countries in some ways just throw more stuff on the ground than other countries? I mean, one professor at Michigan State that you talked to said that if you cycled 100% of all the plastic in Europe and North America, you still wouldn't make a dent on the plastics released into the oceans, because a lot of this, most of this is coming from Asia. Is it just a lack of infrastructure? Is the culture somehow different? I mean, what do you make of that?
There's another interesting number that comes in Jenna's study about the top countries that produce the most of the plastic waste that ends up in the ocean. The United States ends up on that list also,
right,
because the United States produces so much plastic that's used. Now, we're very good at collecting it, or we're a lot better at collecting it than other countries. But we have a lot of products here, so we need to keep in mind that we consume a lot of plastic here. The problem in the developing world is they lack those basic systems of having a garbage collection system, and that's how the plastic gets away from them. So it's not like they're wasteful people. I think people want to say, "Well, that's not what's going on."
Yeah.
It's if you're in a country where you're trying to figure out how to feed and deliver clean water and have get the kids educated in schools. Creation of a municipal garbage collection system is not in the top 5 things on the list, and something needs to be done about that.
Yeah. I have to say just that the piece you write about, or the writing about the waste pickers in Manila, this kind of informal recycling program that you write about, and you profile a man named Armando Siena and his family. The waste picker lives is, I have to say, was a kind of a profound story. I wanted you to say something about that, if you didn't mind.
It's a sad story. This family, he has 3 children and a wife, and they live in a slum, which is ironically called Aroma, which is next door to another slum that is known as Happy Land. And he goes out every day and collects not just plastic, but metal and various other things that can be. He delivers him on a bicycle to a trash dealer who then takes him to the local recycling plant on the outskirts of Manila. And the neighborhood they live in, or the slum that they live in, is literally just brimming with plastic garbage. They live in plastic garbage. It's not like he's going out somewhere and his family is okay. It's everywhere. Yeah. And that really was a heartbreaking thing.
Let's talk about the effects of all of this plastic. It's important to say that this plastic isn't just ugly. Of course, you write about that it's dangerous for marine animals. Let's talk a little bit about that. The visible harm. I mean, there's this photo of a bird enveloped in plastic, of course, but you also write about the invisible harm. Say something about that, because this brings us to this idea of microplastics, which is something I hadn't occurred to me, to be honest.
Yeah, microplastics were discovered only in 2004. Now, they've been there for a long time, but no one was paying too much attention to it. And it was Richard Thompson, the scientist I went to see in Plymouth, who wrote the first paper and said, what is this stuff and where did it come from and how did it get like this? But what it is this plastic that's been in the ocean for a while and has been broken down into these small, tiny little pieces. And then it breaks down further from them into pieces that cannot be seen with the naked eye. Yeah. And this is everywhere in the oceans, and it's on land and it's in the air. And more than 700 species have been cataloged in terms of that they've consumed it, including something as small as zooplankton to whales. Yeah. Birds are eating it. Almost every seabird species is eating it now and will be within the next 10 years, all of them on the whole planet. So the ultimate question is this going to get into the food chain, and is it eventually going to affect us? And we're not there.
Yeah.
As Richard Thompson said to me, he says, we have enough information to know that this is not a good thing, that this is harmful. We don't need to wait for the day when there will be a fish study that shows toxins from the plastic is leaching into the fish flesh, which is not happening now. A lot of fish expel plastic after they eat it. But we also can't say that day is not coming in the future.
Yeah.
And there is enough information out there that this can cause harmful effects that we, meaning the world, can act.
Yeah. You write about going to what seemed to be a pristine beach on the Big Island in Hawaii, standing in what you described as ankle-deep microplastic. And in fact, a lot of what you think is sand on that beach and other beaches, I suppose, a lot of that is just these teeny, teeny grains of microplastics.
Yeah, that's right. I went to Camillo Beach, which is on the side of the Big Island, and on the northeast corner side of the island, it faces the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is the largest collection of garbage swirling in North Pacific Gyre. And that debris just washes off out of the currents, and it washes onto this beach in incredible amounts. They have groups out there that do beach cleanups, and a month later, it's just as bad as it was before. Tiny microplastics, as I said, is ankle deep up to fishing laundry baskets, which are used by fishermen, to oyster spacers, to hagfish traps, bottles, everything.
You say in the article that after that experience on the Big Island in Hawaii, that you could understand why some people would see ocean plastic as this looming catastrophe. But you point out there is an important difference between climate change and all this rampant plastic waste in the ocean. You say, so far there, I want to quote you here, there aren't any ocean trash deniers. And we don't have to completely change the world's energy system like we would to solve climate change. You said, you're sort of getting at this idea that we should be able to figure this out.
There are a lot of people who think we should be able to figure this out. And from sanitation engineers who say, look, this is just a matter of collecting it.
Yeah.
People use it. They need to collect it. And there is no one answer to this problem. Mm. Yes, it's a solvable problem, but it will take the world to solve it. And there are many, many levels and many different ways to get at it. The UN is working on it. They had a big conference about it a year ago. Many countries have started to ban things like plastic bags or straws. The industry has a role to play. There are, in Europe, regulations requiring producers of plastic to take responsibility for the end of life of the products or to pay a tax on various products that will help with the disposal of plastic waste. So there's all kinds of avenues that we should pursue. And there is, as I said earlier, there is no one answer. All of these things have to be dealt with in order to get to the bottom of it.
As you say, we're going to need the participation of large companies, the one who produced this plastic. And you write about two particular things, and you referred to them just a moment ago. The first one is, can they, will they redesign the plastic so it can be recycled more easily? You mentioned that in Europe you have companies who stay with a product throughout the course of its life, from the beginning to the end. In other words, they're thinking about the end of the product. And I'm wondering, there are places where that isn't accounted for, and that seems to be a really important thing in industry, to think about not just the beginning, but what happens when the product's life is over, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the industry is starting to tune in, and there will be a lot of people who will tell you that this is not very impressive, they aren't moving very quickly, there are things that they could be doing, all of which is true. But let's look at the straw ban, for example, because the straw ban, straws got a lot of attention this year.
They have.
And now we see McDonald's and Starbucks and various companies coming out and saying, let's all ban straws. Now, straws is an infinitesimally small amount of plastic waste. It doesn't make that much difference, but it's getting people's attention. It's got these companies' attention. It's an easy thing that they can solve. So they can do that, and that's good, and they should be applauded for that. And then they can move to the next step, which is, if you're running McDonald's or Starbucks, what about plastic lids? What about cups that have plastic lining in them that, in order to keep the coffee from seeping through a cardboard cup? That's the next question. And what about bottles, plastic bottles? All of those questions are going to have to be dealt with, and consumers can, through their choices and through speaking out and drawing attention to things, can also help drive improvements with the industry.
Richard Thompson said that the real solution is to stop all of this plastic from getting into the ocean in the first place. You mention in your article Kenya and other nations banning plastic bags and imposing these fines, and France banning plastic plates and cups by 2020, and bans on plastic microbeads in places like the United States and Canada. I mean, hearing all of this, do you think there is a kind of awareness now? I mean, and do you feel, even as a journalist, optimistic that things are moving on this story?
I think things are moving on it. Whether I feel optimistic about it is an entirely different question. I think that there's a lot about it that's very maddening and frustrating, and you're saying you guys need to move a little faster on this. One of the things that we're doing at National Geographic, which is a little bit different than the normal path we take when we do magazine stories, is when the stories that you refer to that we published in the June issue, it was a package of stories, and it was partnered with a program, a three-year program launched by the National Geographic Society to pursue this issue with scientific research and really explore the dimensions of what do we as the world do about this. And part of it is just for each person to become informed about it and to stop and think about how do they use plastic and what should they be doing differently. How can they alter things so that they maybe use less plastic or fewer items or reuse things multiple times? And all of those things, I think, are sort of part of the answer here. We as the world are not going to ban our way out of this, but bans are helpful, I think, in some circumstances. And they also speak to the manufacturers of various products that say, look, this is a big problem. It's not getting solved. You guys aren't solving it. This is what we've chosen to do because we have to take care of our society. And if you've got a better idea, let's hear it. And I think we're kind of approaching the edge of that.
That's Laura Parker. She's a senior reporter at National Geographic, and we have links to her reporting on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about plastic, which these days seems to be dumped everywhere. The floating islands of plastic in the ocean we've been talking about, depressing and seriously dangerous. We're talking about the problems of plastic today and what it is you can do about it. Joining us now on the program is Beth Terry. She's an accountant, an activist, and a public speaker. She blogs at My Plastic Free Life. She has a book. It's called Plastic Free: How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. She joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. What's changed since you wrote the book? I mean, it's been a few years, and I have to say, it seems like, how were people responding when you first, the book came out, I'm thinking it was 2012 or 2013, I guess it was, and I'm wondering what's changed in the way people are thinking about it, how they reacted then, because now it seems like we're all ready to hear Beth, but were we back in 2012, I guess?
Yeah, well, the book did come out in 2012, and then there was an updated version that came out in 2015 because the book sold better than the publishing company thought it would, and the book is continuing to sell, and the publishing company is continuing to reprint it because as this issue becomes more and more in the mainstream, people are wondering what they can do, what changes they can make in their lives, and what the options are, and you know, like Laura said, this is a problem that is going to require lots and lots of solutions from different angles. And, you know, so, yeah, there are bans and there are changes that need to be made on the governmental level and changes that companies need to make. But we as individuals can be part of the solution in the choices that we make in terms of what we consume. Since 2012, when I first wrote the book, actually since 2007, when I first started this project, it seems like there's been a slow but steady increase in the amount of awareness. And then just within the past year or two, it's exploded, you know, with the National Geographic issue and Earth Day's theme for this year was plastic pollution. And there's just the awareness with the straws and everything is just it's just amazing to me because it felt like a real uphill slog for a while there.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems like everyone has a moment when they start getting really interested in this. We talked with Laura about seeing when she was covering that Malaysian plane that had gone missing, and that got her thinking about this. And I wanted to ask about
that
what seems
such
to,
an interesting story.
Yeah, right. I mean, when people are finally looking down, seeing this stuff, thinking it might be debris from a plane, and in fact, no, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these floating islands of plastic. But I wanted to ask about your image. There's this image that you write about that you saw on a website, and it's, I guess a lot of us have seen this. It's the carcass of an albatross. It's dead, of course, and its body is full of plastic. And you say in your book, nothing affected you as personally as that photo.
Yeah, I considered myself an environmentalist, and I had, you know, gave money to Greenpeace and other environmental organizations, and I watched An Inconvenient Truth and saw polar bears floating on icebergs. And for some reason, none of that really affected me the way this did. And I think the reason was that plastic is so tangible, and I could look at the items in that bird, and they were all things that I used and chose on a daily basis and threw away just without thinking about where they came from or where they were going. And the other part of it that really, really affected me was the fact that it's mother birds that are gathering food for their chicks and mistaking plastic for food and feeding their babies. And that was just heartbreaking to me. And then as I continued to read in that article, I also learned that human mothers, when they feed their children from containers or bottles that are plastic, often the chemicals in the plastic can leach out as well. So, you know, plastic is affecting not just wild animals, but human animals as well.
You begin the book with this declaration. You say, I am an addict. What do you mean?
I think I was a convenience addict. I think I was addicted to the convenience that plastic afforded me, you know, because I didn't want to learn how to cook. So I pretty much lived on frozen dinners and microwavable meals and energy bars and things wrapped in plastic. It made it really easy for me to just grab something and not have to think about it. And I would drink bottled water when I went to the gym, and I would buy whatever I wanted whenever without thinking about the packaging or thinking about where it came from. And it wasn't until I read that article and saw that photo that I suddenly made a connection between my choices and an impact on other creatures, an impact on the planet that I didn't realize I was having. And so I had to change my life, and I had to give up that addiction. And honestly, my life is so much better now because of it. You know, there were unintended consequences, like, for instance, I eat a much more healthy diet now because I'm not living on lean cuisine.
Right. But it raises the question of how much of this is cultural. I kept wondering, why would someone throw a plastic bottle on the ground? In whatever country, and we all do it.
Yeah.
What would possess someone to do that? They just aren't thinking? How does it work in the way you think about it?
Well, so here's the thing. It's not necessarily people throwing bottles on the ground. Yeah, that happens.
Yeah.
And I've seen kids walking down the street just leaving a trail of trash behind them where I live. And that does happen. But I've also seen the recycling truck come and lift up the recycle bin and empty it into the truck, and trash goes flying out all over the street. I've been to visit landfills, and I've been to visit recycling centers and seen trash just blowing everywhere. I mean, they try to keep it contained, but it gets away. And I've seen birds landing in that trash and eating it and carrying it away. Here in the United States, we have waste management, and so we're able to contain it a lot more than in some countries where they just don't have the infrastructure to contain it. Mm-hmm. So some of it is definitely that humans need to be taught to dispose of things properly. But the other thing is, a lot of times this pollution problem is caused not through any fault of the individual. When you're talking about plastic, some of the problem comes even before the plastic is made into a product that you or I could choose at the store in the first place, because the way plastic is sold, it's in little tiny pellet form. And so you have these ginormous bins of plastic pellets that can get loose into the environment and do. In Hong Kong a few years ago, there was a shipwreck, and a huge amount of plastic pellets littered the beach. So these are things that we don't necessarily have control over.
You've mentioned the four R's, the refuse, mm-hmm. reduce, reuse, recycle. I wanted to ask you about the recycle part. Was really interesting to me. You mentioned, as far as plastics are concerned, recycling doesn't really close the circuit, mm-hmm. doesn't close the cycle, and it's more complicated than just throwing this stuff into the recycling bin, which I have to say a lot of us just figure, okay, there's a plastic bag, we'll throw it in the bin, and that sort of diminishes our responsibility at that point. But you say it's more complicated than that.
It is. Well, first of all, recycling is a market. There has to be – you don't just put something in a recycle bin and it automatically gets turned into another product. Yeah. There has to be a company to purchase that raw material and manufacture it into something else. And if the market's not there, if the market is down, if it becomes cheaper to purchase virgin resin rather than to recycle plastic, then a lot of things that people throw into their recycle bins just end up sitting at waste management facilities and ending up in the landfill anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, for many years, the U.S. and European nations collected and shipped their plastic waste to China. And most of the plastic recycling was happening there. And we've seen all kinds of terrible exposés about towns in China that have become very polluted because of the so-called plastic recycling that was happening there. And recently, China instituted something called Operation Green Fence, which means they're not accepting so much trash from the West anymore. And so this is a problem and also an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to develop our own recycling infrastructure here instead of just shipping things away.
You also write about the reuse part of the four R's. And this seems like this is the part about rejecting that cultural imperative of single use, that addiction you had and a lot of us have to convenience.
Yeah. So people can talk about different types of non-plastic disposable cups or non-plastic disposable containers, compostable containers, et cetera, and that's all fine. But to me, a step above that is bringing your own reusables because there's no energy going into then collecting and shipping and composting and recycling, making something that's a single-use product. So I like to bring my own mug when I go out for coffee or whatever. I bring my own stainless steel water bottle. I have a little reusable utensil set. Actually, my favorite thing is a little reusable spork that folds up. And it's very small. I keep it in my purse. And it's very, very useful because you just never know when somebody's going to offer you something. And the only option is a plastic utensil. And I generally, if I'm going to go out to a restaurant, I like to carry a little container with me to bring home leftovers just in case. A lot of this is about being prepared ahead of time, and it takes a while to develop those habits. But at this point, since I've been doing it for 11 years, it's sort of like I grab my keys, I grab my wallet, I grab my reusables. They're in my purse all the time.
You grab your sport.
When I get home, I grab my sport. Yeah. It's in there anyway. Yeah. I rinse it off and put it back.
Right. Beth, do you worry, was there ever a time when you were sort of seen as a caricature, one of those sort of tree hugger types who and how strange that is, and I'm not, you know what I mean? And do you think that you've stopped being that finally the rest of us are going to be as responsible as you are and stop seeing you as some weird sitcom character?
The funny thing about that is I worried about that.
Yeah.
I worried that people would see me that way, and I've gotten very little of that. Every once in a while, I'll get a weird comment on my blog about tree hugging, whatever. Hmm. But in general, I feel like my approach is pretty reasonable. I don't advocate people make all the changes all at once. You know, my book and my website are full of different alternatives people can use instead of plastic. A lot of things that people don't even realize exist. But I never say, do it all at once, you know, or you're bad if you use any plastic. I want people to take a measured approach and look at the plastic waste that they're generating. I mean, I started out by collecting my plastic waste.
Yeah.
And the one thing I did, people ask me, how did you get your husband to join in? And I say, I didn't. I set an example, and he did what he felt like doing. I don't nag. But what I want people to do is be aware of the plastic waste that they're generating, and then just choose a few things to look for options, to look for alternatives.
Wait. Just once before you go on. So what do you mean? So you're making an assessment and you're sort of adding up how much I know that in the book you talk about how you came to the point where you were generating 2 pounds of plastic. Are you better than that now? Are you better than 2 pounds these days?
I think I'm probably still about 2 pounds. And I'll tell you why. It's not 2 pounds of trash. It's 2 pounds of plastic, both recyclable and non-recyclable.
Yeah, wow.
So a lot of times when you see people have all their trash in a mason jar, that seems to be a popular thing now. They're not putting anything in there that's recyclable. That stuff is going in their recycle bin.
Mm.
But because my...
Wow.
And that's fine. I'm not dissing that at all.
Yeah, of course.
I'm just doing... My project just has a different focus, which is fine. And... it's that I want to see actually how much plastic I'm using because I don't think that recycling is a great option.
Yeah.
I want to find alternatives to plastic.
So how do we do that, though? How do you make an accounting of your plastic trash?
So I don't know if you saw, but in my book, there is a worksheet that people can fill out if they want to. And you basically list everything, all your plastic trash for the week. I collected it in a bag under my kitchen table.
Yeah.
And I should disclose that I am a bookkeeper for my day job.
Right. So you're used to making an accounting. Yeah.
Spreadsheets are my life. I actually love spreadsheets. So I think I have the right personality for this. And
I'm looking at one of these spreadsheets, by the way. One ripped grocery bag, 2 chip bags, 14 mini candy wrappers, 1 lid and pump from a can of shave gel. I could go on and on. I mean, this is pretty particular.
I think this list was from the first 6 months, not 1 week.
right.
Oh, and you know, the other thing is I knew that I wouldn't be able to give everything up at once. And so I continued to use up the things that I already had in my house and just replace them as I used them up.
Yeah.
So that picture that you see in the book of me sitting on the floor surrounded by all that plastic, that's all the plastic that was, most of which was already in my house, and some of which was new because I hadn't figured out alternatives yet. Mm. And some of it I didn't even realize was plastic for a while. Like, you know, there's a line of wine bottle corks, they're plastic.
Yeah.
You know, I looked at one day and I went, this is not a real cork.
So how do you start? Making a sort of trying to get a sense of how much plastic is in our lives, right? I mean, is that like the first part?
Yeah, for me it was.
Yeah.
Because that way I could get a grasp on what my personal plastic footprint was. I had no idea. And it's really easy for people to underestimate the amount. Because nobody wants to feel guilty and nobody wants to feel bad. And I don't want anyone to feel guilty. I just want them to look at it scientifically and just be aware. So that's the first part. You know, even if you just do it for a week, it can be eye-opening. Even for some people, if you just do it for a day, it can be eye-opening.
Hmm. And then what?
Then look at it and ask yourself some questions. Okay, what of these things could I eliminate immediately, the low-hanging fruit?
Yeah.
You know, things that I just really didn't need to get.
Yeah.
What things can I find a plastic-free solution for? And then, you know, finally you get to the point where you ask yourself, what things are so important to me that even if a plastic-free solution exists, I wouldn't switch because this thing is really important to me? And then I say, just don't start with that thing. Because I hear so many people say to me, well, I can never go plastic-free because of this and this and this item that I have to have. And I'm like, well, don't start there.
Yeah. How do you shop? How do you grocery shop? That's the thing I think about all the time. Like, okay, but in the produce section, there's all those little plastic bags. And how do you do it?
So I don't take those plastic bags.
Yeah.
I have reusable cloth bags that I bring with me to the grocery store. There are cotton bags and net bags that you can get. And if you shop in a natural food store, a lot of times they'll sell them there. If not, sometimes people make them themselves. Sometimes people buy them online. And a lot of times the bags, like Eco Bags, for example, that's a brand. I'm not necessarily advocating that brand, but they'll have the tear weight of the bag on the tag so that when you check out, if it's the type of store where they can deduct the weight of the bag, like a Whole Foods type place, they can deduct that and give you credit for it. But, you know, those cloth bags are so lightweight that sometimes they'll just give you a certain amount of credit for it anyway.
But forget that part. I mean, it's just it seems like it requires a lot of planning, trying to find bulk products. I mean, you really have to think this through. It's that's part of the problem, I guess, is we like convenience.
Which is, yeah. And this is why I don't encourage people to do it all at once.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Take a visit. And I say this in my book, too. Take a visit to a store, a grocery store that has bulk bins, and check them out. See what's in the bulk bins that's available for you. What types of things are in those bulk bins that you could substitute for something that you would have bought in a plastic package? And try it out. Bring a bag, bring a jar, bring something, and try purchasing your some kind of product without plastic packaging and see how it feels. You have to find out. Different stores have different ways of allowing you to do that, so it's going to require some questions. But a lot of the how-tos, how to shop, are in the book and on the website. And there, and on Facebook, you know, there's a huge community of people that are living this way and giving advice to each other.
Yeah.
There's one Facebook group that people might want, if they're interested, might want to join called Journey to Zero Waste. And it's not necessarily plastic-focused, but there's a lot of crossover. And it's just people giving each other advice about this and that and the other.
It's interesting you write in the book, you mentioned being raised in the Mormon church and how you were taught to speak up, as you say, for what is right. And it seems like in some ways that, even though you haven't been Mormon for some time, that informed in some ways how you think about this. Tell me how you make the transition from being profoundly moved by this photo of an albatross carcass. And actually doing something about it. Because, I mean, we're all moved by those kinds of things. But then the action point seems to be the tricky part.
You know, it has to do with choosing the right. does that...
That resonates in this state. Boy, yeah, people will know what you mean. Yeah.
And even, you know, I mean, that can be applied, and I hope it is applied in every aspect of our lives, right? If you learn that something you're doing or something that you're – a choice that you're making is causing harm in some way, you can choose to do a different thing. And to me, reducing my plastic consumption is choosing the right. And it makes me feel good, even though I know that my personal changes are not going to solve the entire problem. In my heart, it feels right to act this way. And then – my actions are magnified by the example that I set, by the example that all of us set for other people. So, for example, when my husband takes a stainless steel pot to the butcher shop for meat, they know him now, and they just put the meat in there. And people will come up to him and say, "Wow, I didn't know you could do that."
Yeah.
This is in Oakland, mind you,
yeah.
where this is a little bit more common. I want to say, you know, not every area has all the resources available, but there are things everyone can do no matter where they live. Mm.
You tell the story from, I think this was the spring of 2010, and you were on this beach in Northern California with some artists who, in fact, make art out of found plastic. And you tell the story of feeling this deep sadness rush over you, this sense of, I don't know, it seems like you were overwhelmed, a kind of hopelessness overcame you.
That's exactly it.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because then your focus shifted.
Yeah. I looked at how much plastic was on that beach, and I just felt powerless for a second. I felt completely overwhelmed and powerless, and like nothing I was doing was making a difference. And then I thought, I don't have to focus on the entire problem. All I have to focus on is what's right in front of me right now. Like I say in the book, I made a game out of it, you know. The artists that were on the beach, they called it curating the beach because they realized they couldn't clean up the entire thing. So they would just pick and choose things of different colors and different shapes that they could use in their art. And so I started doing that too, and it became fun. And I knew that I was helping in a way, but I didn't have to take on the entire responsibility for the problem myself, because That's a little hubristic, actually, when you think about it, thinking that you are responsible for all of the world's problems. We each need to do our part.
That's Beth Terry. Her blog is called My Plastic Free Life. Her book is Plastic Free: How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. She joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.